A steep and winding road, designed mainly for horses, drays, and the odd 3-ton truck. This was the Pacific Highway in 1958, when the last tortuous section of gravel was sealed with bitumen. Described by some as a goat track, the Pacific Highway was named so in 1931 because of pressure put by the Queensland government, who had decided to rename their section of road from Tweed Heads to Brisbane the Pacific Highway. Before then, it was simply known as the North Coast Highway, a road used only as a last resort. Vince O'Grady, a former Deputy Engineer-in-Chief of the Department of Main Roads, recalls.
The Pacific Highway defines the history of the evolution of people and goods movement within this state. Initially, it was shipping. Sydney to Newcastle, you went by ship. And Sydney to Windsor, you went out the Heads and you came back in on the Hawkesbury River.
John Brunt was the head of environmental planning at the DMR. He remembers being on holiday once in Yamba during the 1940s.
I had a holiday once in Yamba and looking out of my window at the hotel, there was a beer used to be brought in by ship. And they had heavy seas and the ship couldn't get in across the bar. So they were contemplating Grafton and Yamba but running out of beer.
Colin Nunn, development manager at the RTA in Newcastle, gives an idea of what it was like to have been a motorist on the Pacific Highway during the 1930s.
The motorists would have realised that when they were going out, it's going to be a hot, dusty or wet, boggy trip in a lot of instances. It would have been a massive adventure for them because they would have to be facing up with uncertain road conditions. Will they get bogged? Will some of the creeks be flooded? They would probably have to take some additional supplies, I would imagine. Getting there was probably more important than getting there on time. I don't imagine people doing any more than a 150 miles a day in those days. I couldn't see them planning a longer trip than that. To drive the Pacific to New Sydney to Brisbane, you would have been crazy. Going that far in those days, people would think you had a screw loose if you took a car. You've got to realise that back in the 30s, there wasn't a lot of motor vehicles. In around Australia, was a relatively poor country. It went through the Depression and it was did it much tougher than a lot of other countries. So motor vehicle usage was fairly low. So it would have been a domain of the rich or the adventurers or the aficionados or those sorts of people, I would imagine.
Tom Hope, former engineer-in-chief, recalls.
We bought our first car when we were at Dorigo in 1946. And it used to take 15 hours to drive from Dorigo and or Coffs Harbour to Sydney. And mostly over gravel. Stone.
Tom Lindsay is now a truck operator. In 1945, he was a 14-year-old on his first trip from Coffs Harbour to Sydney.
Which was my father in a truck. Yes, on the back of a truck too, not in the cab. And there was about two-thirds of the Pacific Highway was gravel. And we were wrapped in blanket and with a tarpaulin over the bottom half of our body. We certainly needed a shower when we got there.
I mean, it's interesting, even close to Newcastle, it was a massive trip and sometimes between Maitland and Newcastle, people had to wade in bullocks up to their waist to get through the Hexham Swamp. It's interesting, though, that in the 30s and the New South Wales railway system came to Murwillumbah and the Queensland system came to Tweed Heads. And one significant reason why they spent a fair amount of money joining the road system between Murwillumbah and Tweed Heads, including those two bridges and eliminating those two ferries, was to join the rail heads together. In the Depression, we had a new bridge at Maxville, Boyd's Bay, Barney's Point, Raleigh, Maroro. I mean, significant capital works were spent eliminating ferries up there, Shark Creek. We actually even had the new route put in between Newcastle and Sydney via Pete's Ferry. It was a very interesting time for the road in the 30s. Even then, I think the New England was seen as the major route and the major freight route.
During the post-war years, with increasing car ownership and population mobility, the realisation grew that the highway would not be able to cater for the expected future needs. With cars now able to reach speeds of 70 miles per hour on a road designed at 1939 standards, and an influx of tourism to coastal communities and increasing traffic volumes, the DMR realised that something had to be done. In 1947, Vince O'Grady had just graduated with a brand new engineering degree in his pocket. He had no trouble finding a job.
Jobs were extremely plentiful. Didn't have to apply for jobs. The jobs came looking for us. There were 27 of us did civil at that time, and two that are paying the most of the Water Resources Commission and Main Roads. I had a close friend, and up went the penny. He got the Water Resources Commission. I got the Main Roads Department. It was actually a toss. So on a Monday morning in February, in my best suit, my only suit, all spruced up, I went in to start work in the structural design section. Oh, look, we'd like to do something else. We'd like to go and see the highways engineer. The highways engineer said, we want you as a field assistant to the Metropolitan Construction Engineer. It was a wet day, so in my best suit by lunchtime, I was out putting in pegs on the Pacific Highway between Crow's Nest and St Leonard's. It was a four-lane road at that time, with the two centre lanes carrying trams, and you could not legally pass a tram on the right-hand side. You couldn't move past a stationary tram. So in morning peaks, the head of the queue was always a tram. We started work at 7 o'clock, a three-quarter hour lunch, and if you work it out, we knocked off about, well, just after 4:30, I think it was, to get the 44 hours in the 5 days. Concreting was always a big thing for the men because it was a very hard day, and you always started at daylight and you went until you lost the light. In other words, while the weather was good, keep going. Cement came in paper bags. Concrete aggregate came in two sizes. We didn't let traffic on normally for 28 days after pouring. If it had to be quicker, extra bag of cement went into every mix and opened in 7 days.
O'Grady's boss was Bob Milner, a colourful character who had been a captain with Lawrence of Arabia whilst in the Indian Army. The men just called him Uncle Bob.
But one particular day, I remember, we got, well, one lane concreted all the way from Chandos Street right up to Falcon Street. And I thought it might have been a record, but perhaps it wasn't. And I was just standing there with the foreman, and we're congratulating ourselves when Uncle Bob turned up. Oh, you went well, yes. While he was standing there, while the three of us were there, a little sedan car, might have been an Austin or a Morris, worked its way between the barriers at the bottom down at Chandos Street, got onto the wet concrete, and as the car advanced, of course, it started to make depressions in the wet concrete, finally bogged about 40 yards short of us. And it's a terrified local housewife. She's just not going to move. Well, she couldn't move the vehicle. She wasn't going to do anything. Uncle Bob just gave a signal, and about 8 men got round the car, picked the car up with the woman still behind the steering wheel, carried it across, put it onto the tram tracks, and he said, "Have a good evening, madam."
Peter Cooper is a former locations officer at the DMR and the RTA.
In the 1950s, the DMR did something so enormous that it probably will never be completed. And they decided that the road from Taree to Newcastle that used to go through Gloucester and Stroud would come down through Woolloodeala and Tea Gardens. 120-kilometre deviation. Can you imagine that in the late 90s, to even talk about such a thing? This was an enormous decision, and they just went ahead and did it. They had very limited resources, money-wise, so they knew they just had to keep doing this until it was finished. And there was confidence, and there was an enthusiasm to get in, and yes, we're going to do it. Today, we would have so many studies, so many inquiries and investigations, and changes of government in between, that the concept would probably never get off the ground.
Cooper joined the DMR as a junior draftsman in 1950 and spent his first year in the investigation section. But he really wanted to become a surveyor.
There's a degree of romanticism about surveyors. As a kid growing up, that was a, that'd be great to do, wouldn't it?
To you, what is surveying all about? What's the essence of it? What's the important thing about being a good surveyor?
Being methodical. Being able to plan things.
And what about the recognition of different kinds of terrain and curves and all that sort of thing?
Well, in this business that I was involved in, that's fundamental. O'Grady, at the time, we were looking for somebody, for a new person to come into this activity, and he said he wanted a fellow with the smell of gun leaves up his nose. He wanted somebody from the bush with an appreciation of what the terrain might be like. And what happens, like streams flow downhill. Like, you didn't have to look at a map and look at levels to know that. This was traditional surveying, and nobody had heard of photogrammetry. Nobody had heard of aerial photographs. We did topographic surveys by means of what was known as stadia, where a vertical staff is held. And wherever you are, you read the distance on the staff, on the crosshairs through the telescope of the theodolite. In those days, we filled out a fortnightly journal in which was specified how many hours you spent doing various things, down to a quarter of an hour, how you spent the day. So much field work, so much office work, the cost of postage stamps. This was a fortnightly journal of your activities.
Jack Giddy, a senior road design draftsman, joined the DMR at the age of 15.
We were designing roads in long lengths. You know, we're talking about 20 or 30 kilometres, just stringing them together. And we developed, or we used a section where we spread the, had the plans printed, the contours, and the photogrammetry printed out in sheets 30, 40 feet long. We were working to get coordination between the vertical alignment and the horizontal alignment, and all the factors, all the safety factors that are required to come into road design, we could do then. And the draftsmen working on those jobs were able to perceive, or had a good knowledge of how the road would look when it was finished.
Equipment used in the drafting office was basic. John Henley, now a Shire engineer at Tweed Shire Council, started with the DMR at the Port Macquarie Works office in 1966.
It was still very much the days of the pencil and the ink pen, and everything was drawn by hand. Calculations were all done by hand calculators. We did, early days, we did at least have electric calculators, even though they were mechanical ones. But all detailed calculations were still done with the old seven-figure logs. And surveyors in the field, they used to still use the hand-wind calculators where you'd set them and mechanically wind them. And there was still quite a number around then of the old wind-the-handle mechanical calculators. You had an electric one where you actually pressed the button. That was a big step forward.
In my field, the greatest advancement was, the development of aerial photography and air photo interpretation.
Another important tool used by the DMR for road location was photogrammetry.
Photogrammetry is the science of using aerial photographs to generate a graphical representation of the terrain. The Department of Main Roads were one of the first users of this system, and from the aerial film, plates are made. Plates are put in these plotting instruments, and people can see the three-dimensional representation of the terrain. The DMR in the 1930s started taking aerial photography on the Pacific Highway and various other highways. In advance of anybody else in Australia, they started doing this. So we've had a long history of reliance on aerial photographs. And in the late 60s, they started to use colour photography. And we used aerial photography in three dimensions. Well, here was a fourth dimension.
From the 60s on, nearly all the location and preliminary work was done from photogrammetry. It was about that time the department had its own helicopter, and we did a lot of work from that. We were getting a better understanding with the engineers and with the so-called hierarchy of the main roads by having them acknowledge the fact that the most important part of the car or the most important part of design is the nut behind the wheel or the driver, and a realisation of the limitations of that driver and putting these limitations into design, which gave a completely different attitude in the approach to road design.
One of the products is to be able to draw contours and spot and take spot heights very, very accurately. It's so accurate that generally when people are first presented with this, they doubt it, that there is some degree of speculation that it can't be right. But in fact, it's true. The DMR bought two cameras for close-up work. They actually did some experimental stuff, some research on potholes, and did a contour survey of a pavement from 4 feet away, drawing contours of, I think, half a millimetre precision.
The complete computerisation of design, fortunately, came after I left. It was coming in as I was leaving. Thank goodness for that. Because I'd seen a situation in Queensland where they try to use computer design, and they've come up with some of the most, well, in my opinion, some of the most dangerous pieces of road you could imagine. And that was because I think the people that were computer designers weren't road designers. They knew about computers, but they didn't know the basis on road design or road design safety.
Only in the last few years has become computers with enough memory to handle all the data at once in a system called GIS, Geographic Information Systems, in which data is overlaid as if you had pieces of paper with all different bits of information on it, sitting one on top of the other, all perfectly coordinated. Well, they do this in a computer using these national grid coordinates. Where it gets really interesting is the ability of the computer to analyse or do analysis on the things that you are really looking at. And if you say you attach 100% importance to environmental issues and 80% importance to topographic issues, let's see where the points of conflict are.
During the 1950s and 1960s, traffic volumes on the Pacific Highway increased dramatically, more than quadrupling pre-war figures. Increasing traffic congestion on the two-lane highway made improvements imperative.
Overtaking lanes were really relatively rare at that stage. Overtaking lanes, in fact, I don't recall them being used anywhere except as climbing lanes. Only at that stage, the only facility for that third lane was, in fact, climbing lanes, which all went back to what heavy trucks were in use at that stage, being relatively low-powered and crawling up hills very slow. And the section from down around Bulladela, which was relatively new at that stage, was considered to be, you know, one of the very good sections of highway because it had climbing lanes on nearly every hill.
Deviations and road widenings were welcomed, but when towns were bypassed, new problems emerged for local populations. Terry O'Brien, former engineer based at Port Macquarie.
Well, the one at Port Macquarie, for instance, was my first involvement. The only snag was that when people came up from Kew through this winding section through the forest, got out onto this brand new road, they just kept going, and that was opened just before Christmas. And then the people would ring from Kempsey to the motels at Port Macquarie and say, oh, I'll cancel my booking because I'm now at Kempsey, I'm heading north. And we stopped a couple of vehicles after they'd gone past this turn-off, and the driver said, yes, I saw the sign. I told my wife and mother-in-law that Port Macquarie was off to my right, and they said, don't be stupid, this is the way we've always come. So he said, I just kept going.
The local establishments at Port Macquarie were not so happy about the new bypass.
Hated it. I didn't want to be bypassed. The commercial people didn't want to be bypassed. But the highway used to go into Port Macquarie, right into the middle of Port Macquarie. That was one of the first that was built out of town. And the dire consequences were forecast. What a godsend it was. Made Port Macquarie.
Bangalore was the example where the traffic was just nose to tail for long periods. And, it really divided. And now that they bypassed it, it's a lovely little town, totally different. The towns, they seem to stagnate for a while. They don't seem to know how to handle being bypassed initially. But then after a few years, they seem to go from strength to strength when they realise that there is another life without all the traffic roaring through the town.
Ron Smythe, a former divisional engineer with the DMR, recalls.
Raymond Terrace was bypassed, but that bypass is now being bypassed again. In fact, it's opening this week. That's one of the mistakes that the DMR made in those days, was that they bypassed the main street of Raymond Terrace with another road, and then the council would allow development to happen on the bypass, and that's exactly what happened at Raymond Terrace. That bypass that was built then has become choked up with service stations, restaurants, houses, etc., and become a suburban street once again. So the current bypass will bypass that, and hopefully there'll be no development allowed on it.
Much of the DMR's activities to improve the highway centred around the works depots, often in remote areas. Leo D'Adam, a former divisional engineer at Port Macquarie, remembers.
In those days, up to when I got there, the engineers out on work sites had to camp in tents and paid for it. They paid $5 a week for it to live in a tent.
Brian Pearson also spent a year with the DMR at the Port Macquarie Works Office.
There was always an extra tent, and I didn't know what that tent was used for. And one day I poked my head inside and it was full of empty bottles. And I learnt from the foreman in charge of that camp, it was traditional practice, and when the tent couldn't take any more, he loaded all the bottles into a lorry and took them away to a dump. But for the sake of peace, I didn't want to interfere with that practice.
They were truly frontier days.
When we took the pay down from Bulladeel to Karoo, we used to take a shotgun.
We had our own bed, you know. The beds were provided, and a cupboard alongside the bed, and a chair you could sit in. No carpets on the floor. The tents were boarded up to about 2 foot height. We had a cook, Edgar, as I remember him. And when he was sober, produced reasonable meals.
Don McDean is a former labourer, ganger and bulldozer driver. He worked on the Bulladeela to Karua section of the highway during the 1950s.
We had a little 10x10 igloo thing for each bloke. Oh, it wasn't too bad. It was had a big galley, cook your own feed. Used to have a bloke in the yard, and he'd have the water boiling for you when you got home and the fire lit to cook your tea, and had the hot water in that there for you to have your shower, and it was pretty crummy showers too. Oh, yeah, we used to just have a big barbecue, and the pipes for the hot water, they run through the big barbecue and up into a 244-gallon drums stuck together, and that was our hot water supply.
So what was the atmosphere like in those camps then? Was it good?
Oh, fairly good. It was what you made it. You know, sometimes it used to get a little bit hopstropolis, but used to quieten down.
Anyone ever complain about the conditions?
Well, it wasn't much good of complaining because you didn't get anything done for you. Yeah, well, them days we had to nap all the big stone down to a certain size, and then they used to put the grid rollers over it. Once we got them down to, say, 6 inches, see, some of the rock used to be up to 2 foot across. We used to have to bash them down to that size. You had to more or less look for the grain in the rock, and if you knew where to hit, they'd fall apart fairly easy. But if you didn't, you could bash there all day.
Equipment was often basic. Tom Hope mentions mostly hand labour, and on the Pacific Highway in 1937, a lack of mechanised construction machinery.
It was mostly handwork or pneumatic tyre tractor-drawn equipment, even horses and drays. And out in the western part of the state, camels and drays.
In those days, we were very short of construction equipment. What bulldozers we had were ex-army and had already exhausted their first life, so continually under repair.
McDean also worked on the Karua section of the Pacific Highway. Some of the rocks that he unearthed were monumental in size.
It took two HD20s one day to get one out of a hole down at Karua, and that was, I'd say it was 8 foot high by about 10 foot wide. And I couldn't lift him, so I got my mate to come in with me, and we got him out in the finish. And he's still sitting down there for anybody to see, actually.
Did you ever see any accidents?
Yes, I see a bloke, he was dozing one day in a quarry just out of Bulladoola, and he went in under this big shelf of rocks, and the rock face fell on him, and it smashed the tractor into three pieces and put him into hospital and crippled him for the rest of his life.
What was his name, do you remember?
Digger Magaway. Yeah, and he went to Waratah after that, and they gave him a job in the laboratory. He supposed to have a job there for life, and when the laboratory closed down at Waratah and went into divisional office, they sacked him because he was crippled up that way, that they used to pick him up from his house and bring him into the lab. And when they moved it into Waratah, they just said, well, we're not picking you up anymore, and he couldn't get the job. So they done the dirty on him.
How was the DMR as an employer, though, generally? Were they good employers?
They wasn't too bad.
Big changes in the use of construction equipment and materials occurred during the 1950s.
The changes in the years that I was in the main race was so dramatic it looked like going to another planet. When I first joined the main race on the Belmont Climbing Lane work, we introduced bulldozers, which were just imported from overseas, which had hydraulic rippers, which were the first to be used by the main roads in this state, and hydraulic blades. And before that, we had the old type tractors with cable mechanisms, which looked like a horse-drawn vehicle. We came then, got into the era of vibrating rollers, which minimised the use of water on the roads. We came into concrete paving machines, sophisticated machines, could do up to 2 kilometres of concrete pavement per day, or 8 metres wide. Sophisticated levelling gear, laser levelling, the type of trucks being used, the bitumen sprayers. It was a complete evolution, really, plant over those years, and which is, since I've left, has even gone even much further.
Bitumen at the time, well, typically in country areas, was the flash seal, as it was always called. Gravel was a graded stone down to dirt, which was packed and to attempt to get the right amount of moisture in, roll it and grade it. And then a spray, usually of tar, went on as a binder. That was used mainly because tar would stick to anything. Bitumen is a lot more choosy. And then a spray of bitumen went down, and while it was still hot, chippings or screenings or fine-breaked stone, and then the traffic was asked to move fairly slowly for the next week or so while the bitumen set up a bit, which they didn't do. So country work, flush seal work, I used to average 7 broken windscreens to the mile.
My first appointment was to the Port Macquarie Works office, and I was the assistant works engineer. But in the time I was there, we did some work on the Pacific Highway, and we would had one of the failed attempts on the Clybucker Flats north of Kempsey, because the road was nearly worse afterwards than before. And there was various theories coming out as to how to fix it. The year I was there, the current theory was to use tar stabilisation. In other words, mixing tar in with your road-based gravel and then sealing, which we did. It was an absolutely shocking job to work on because of the tar fumes. But men that worked on it, you know, tar fumes just burnt all of their skin, and in current day, I mean, work cover would kill you. You just wouldn't be allowed to work in those conditions. But we did it, and we got it, and we finished it. But within about 12 months, it had all deformed and gone back out of shape again. The theory of the tower stabilisation just didn't work up there or wasn't suitable for that location. And over the years, there's been all sorts of stabilisation across there. I think cement stabilisation, probably some lime, and it wasn't until very recently when they actually put a concrete pavement across there. It is the only answer. But there was many failed attempts on the Clybucker Flats over the years.
Because of the scarcity of road-making materials, they had used a limestone aggregate on some of the sections, particularly south of Kempsey. The only snag was that that limestone over time had got polished date, and in wet weather it was like an ice skating rink. And I can recall there were six vehicles in one collision, like a stock car derby at one stage. So I don't think there was anybody hurt, but it prompted a fair bit of response and then using a different type of aggregate for a reseal.
In the post-war years, the Pacific Highway from Cowan to the Hawkesbury River became totally inadequate in the face of increasing motor vehicle ownership and population growth. At this time, the Central Coast was becoming a popular tourist area.
There was congestion between Sydney and Newcastle, mainly. What happened in the people, even in those days, didn't go on the longer type holiday trips. The Central Coast was still a fairly powerful, significant tourist area. I think in the 50s there was up to 18,000 vehicles per day in holiday period on the road, and clearly it was a torturous trip on the old Pacific Highway, and it took over five hours to get to Newcastle, and it probably took, you know, at some stage 3 hours to get to Gosford and the entrance in those holiday places up there.
Kevin Kirkland was a driver in his father's bus company during the 1950s.
Well, the road was very narrow, windy, and some sections narrow and dangerous. It would take sometimes, I remember from Gosford to Sydney, on a Sunday afternoon, it took us up to 5 hours to get to Sydney.
The obvious solution was to build a freeway from Sydney to Newcastle, a very ambitious plan at the time. The decision to build the first section from the Hawkesbury River to Mount White was taken in 1960.
It was at this time that the first of the big contractors looking for roadworks, well, they were all saying, you know, you fellows just play around with building it, give it to us and we'll build it cheaper and we'll build it well. And Neville Wran was Premier, Pat Hills was Minister for Roads. Pat Hills wanted to get them off his back a bit. Howard Sherard as Commissioner for Main Roads at the time, he wouldn't have a bar of letting this stuff out to contract. He just didn't want to be in it. So anyway, Pat Hill said, well, the best way to get rid of them is give them a go, call tenders. And very quickly, under his direction, a tender specification was put together to design and construct a toll road from Sydney at least as far as the latitude of Gosford. We're all convinced. No tender. None of them would know how to write a tender for that. They had no way of getting an estimate of cost. They'd be shooting in the dark. Didn't expect any tenders. Tender time was up. Opened the box. There's two tenders in there. One from the Tease Brothers, which was a load of rubbish, completely non-complying. It went straight into the bin. That was the end of that one. The other one was from a man named Solomon. None of us knew who Solomon was. An address in London. Wow. Sherard's immediately offside to him. He didn't want him. And one of the requirements was the tenderer had to have in hand, in effect, £50 million to start. Solomon gave as the source of his £50 million, £50 million that he had in the Bank of England in London. Direction to the legal officer. Jeff Sheldon was the chief legal officer. Would you make arrangements and ring the Bank of London and find out if a Mr. Solomon has £50 million and is it earmarked available for this? And I said, please, Mr. Sherard, can I stay back with him that night with the phone call? I won't talk. So Jeff put the call in about 8:15 one night. And as soon as he started to talk, where he was from, what it was about. Yes, at the other end, the Bank of England, yes, you wish to speak to Mr. So-and-so. Mr. So-and-so came on the line. Yes, you're inquiring about Mr. Solomon and his assets to get a major road built. Yes, he has got $50 million lodged with us for that purpose, and he would have access to more money. Well, that would be pretty obvious if he had $50 million in the bank sitting. Oh. We couldn't get to work soon enough the next morning to tell Sherrard. Is the proposal economical? Well, that was my job. A road works typically if you cost the cost of the road and the cost of the benefits, and you put one over the other and you get a cost-benefit return, and any reasonable road work pays 10% or better. The largest one I'd ever seen was 22% benefit over cost per annum. This came out over 40. Wow. So I was directed to do that and have it ready within. Yeah, Sherrard, you know, he didn't give you much time to do things. Next meeting committee. I said, it's 42%, it's da-da-da-da. That's enough. I don't want to hear any of the tech. Oh, I don't. So he had to report to the minister, Pat Hills. And then I was told to be ready at 11 o'clock with the plans and figures and the mosaic in the recreation room. The doors are locked. Then in comes Sherrard and Pat Hills and nobody else. Oh. So anyway, Pat Hills heard it right through. And then he looked at Sherrard and he said, well, Howard, I think we give him a go. Well, I'm sitting here or standing there watching history being made now. And then the next line from Sherrard, Mr. Minister, you've got to give yourself another commissioner. I'm not going to do it. Whew. Pat Hills looks at me with a little bit of a grin and he says, that commissioner of yours hits hard, doesn't he? And that was the end of that.
Eric King was engineer in charge of outer freeways construction at the DMR.
Yeah, it was a challenge, I suppose, because we were moving into earthworks, the size of which we'd never tackled before. Drilling, blasting were of a magnitude that we'd never had before.
That was the showpiece of highway engineering in New South Wales, and probably rated as good if, or better than anything else in Australia, and was at that stage almost world class. And that was great, because you really felt you were working on a project that everyone that drove a car was looking at with admiration and saying, oh, wouldn't it be lovely if we had interstate highways, etc. like that. So it was good. It gave me a different insight, because I'd gone from the construction to design side, so it gave me a totally different appreciation of road design. But the beauty with the Sydney-Newcastle was that it wasn't like the normal rural highways where you were building very much to a budget. At that stage, the standard was to build a very high-speed, safe road and then see what it was going to cost, rather than we've got to build X kilometres of road for Y amount of money. We went to 4 6-lane divided, completely access-controlled highways. Everything else was just 2 lanes.
There was a challenge of moving thousands and thousands of cubic yards of sandstone in such a manner as could be assured of being stable in embankments which were up to 80 feet in depth, and cuttings almost as high as that also.
Well, I think the single biggest challenge was the what we call the Big Cut and the Big Fill, which are on the south of the Hawkesbury River. It was the biggest cutting and the biggest fill, and I think it still is the biggest fill that we've ever built in Australia for a road. One big problem that you have to be careful of is the effect of blasting on properties nearby. Fortunately for a lot of the work we did up there, it was out in the uninhabited areas, but when we got down around Moonee, we had to be careful. People have got cracks in the walls of their buildings, and they complained, and we had to then we adopted a system before we moved into an area. If there was a house or a building that could be involved, that was inspected and photographed and so on before the work started, and then checked afterwards. We had one claim from an establishment at Mooney, which we knew could not have been affected by our blasting, but we paid up because it was a convent and we couldn't dispute the Mother Superior that she wasn't telling the truth. We had one unfortunate accident on the job when a rock was pushed over from one of the contract dozer driver, pushed a rock over the side, which was too big to have been pushed over, and he pushed it over, it bounced off a berm and bounced down on the Pacific Highway down below and landed fair on top of a car and killed two people. The car was just driven into the road. They didn't know whether it was they were male or female or what, but the whole thing was just squashed into the road. The whole thing sounds very callous, but the insurance company who were handling the matter came to see me, and the chap said, "Oh, look," he said, "we've got nothing to worry about." He said it was an old chap and his son, and he said, "There's only the mother left," and he said, "She's pretty old, and she won't last too long," and he said the son was a bachelor, so payout's going to be minimal. He said, and I nearly threw him out of the office. This fellow had no feeling at all about the suffering that woman must have gone through.
There were some problems with the pavement surface on that first section of the freeway.
Well, on the initial length, the asphalt that was laid as the finished surface was a dense graded asphalt. And the water, during times of rain, well, rainfall, the water, although it was running off the road to the drains at the side, there was always a thin film of water on the top. And when a car was coming around the curve, and the curves were really too small in radius for the speeds that the cars we were adopting, and quite a number, and it was a combination, I guess, of worn tyres too, but the car could lose traction or lose attraction in the rear wheel spin. And of course, once it gets out of control, there's nothing you can do about it. You've just got to go with it. So there were a number of these accidents occurred, and I actually witnessed one once when I was in the car with Mr. George Faulkner, who was the engineer in chief at the time. We were following a car during rain, and this actually happened. The car smashed into the side of the cutting. Nobody was hurt, but the car was dented, but it was drivable, and the chap drove away. But that's when we started looking for means of avoiding or overcoming this problem, and they developed this open-graded mix, which suited our purposes, and we overcame that problem.
There were also problems with the route of the highway planned to go through a national park.
When you get up near Mount White, you'll notice a cutting that heads off to the right, where over a million cubic yards of rock was taken out, and you know that's $1 million worth or more of work was done and abandoned. The intended route of the freeway was to go down through this cutting. It was a shorter route, but certain people in the national parks and wildlife, this route went through national park area, so they said they didn't want it to go through this area. It was the logical route to take. It was the shortest route and the easiest one. But here you have the situation within a government where one government department is up against another government department, and one minister against another minister, and a premier is not game to make a decision. And after a lot of argument, it was decided that we would abandon that route and take the route that it follows now. And the funny thing was that after we'd made that decision and we'd started to do the redesign, the minister who handled the National Parks and Wildlife Service went on leave, and the minister for Main Roads took over in an acting capacity for National Parks and Wildlife Service. And during that time, he signed a document which extended another national park, and it included the new route of the road. And immediately, National Parks and Wildlife Service asked for the road to be diverted again. And our minister was in this position of having signed the document. After a lot of argument, sanity prevailed and we stuck to the line.
Eric King recalls the circumstances regarding the official opening of the Barara to Hawkesbury section of the freeway, involving the then Minister for Roads, the Honourable Pat Morton.
We had a section to open when we moved on this, the southern side of the river. They wanted to open the section on a certain date. We thought we'd open it January of the following year. And our minister at the time said it wasn't good enough. It had to be before Christmas so that the Christmas traffic could have it. And then he had a bright idea that his birthday was in October. And he said, well, that's the date I want it opened. And we said, it's impossible, sir. It cannot be done. And then the commissioner, John Shaw, at the time, he said, it can't do it. So the minister turned to me and put me right in the spot and said, you can do it, Mr. King, can't you? And I said, I'm sorry, the commissioner said we can't, and we can't. He said, well, what would you need to be able to do it? I said, we'd have to work two shifts a day, and we would need another, I forget the amount now, maybe $1 million or so extra. And all he said was, you've got it. And we did it. We opened it on the 27th of October, which was the minister's birthday.
The next section of the freeway was the Burunga to Barara sector, and here the DMR ran into some considerable environmental problems.
The line that we'd selected ran through Muagamara Sanctuary, and there was a particular baronia growing in that area that only grew there. Grows nowhere else along the escarpment. And the chap who looked after the Muagamara Sanctuary appealed to us to shift the line to avoid it, and we did.
Six wombats had been observed. Wombats, if they're on a regular route, typically a route to water, they're not going to be deviated off that by anybody. You put a fence up, they'll go under it.
So we put in this big corrugated sheet culvert to enable the movement across in this national park where we'd gone, so that they could move within the park without any trouble. And when we built it and put it into operation, there were a lot of jokes and things about whether you had to put up signs telling the wombats where to go and so on. But to establish whether it was being used or not, they'd spread sand at the entrance to the or through the culvert, and prints would be checked, and it was used. They could tell whether it was a wombat or whether it was a rat or a bush rat or whatever, and certainly was used.
So the wombats are smarter than you think?
The wombats didn't need to be instructed, yeah.
Anyhow, the location was finalised, more or less, with acceptance of national parks. It went to the minister. The minister asked for a formal model to be made, which was quite an elaborate model. Anyway, the model went to Laurie Brereton as minister, but the minister was still worried or concerned. Environmental significance and whether this job should take such a high precedence. One of his phrases I can still remember, why do we need a freeway leading from the blue blood country to the north? Why don't you build more roads out Bagstown way where the real people are? I thought on that one and I thought of an answer for that. I said, the people living up north round Woi Woi are retired good Labour voters, and the traffic is their sons and daughters going to see them at the weekends.